Good evening. Welcome to the Solaria Report. Today is Thursday, April 21st, 2011. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets, and Ask Catherine, and then a great discussion with Blake Levitt, who was with us in March to talk about electromagnetic fields and electromagnetic radiation. And we got so many questions and some great questions on smart grid, and it's such an urgent topic for many people, particularly in California, but other states where there's a real effort to roll them out, that we thought, let's just get Blake back right away. And sure enough, she agreed to come back. And so tonight, beware the smart grid. We're going to talk about what smart grids are and why you should care about that. And then let's go to the movies. We're going to be reviewing Full Signal, The Hidden Cost of Cell Phones. Blake also appears in that documentary. It's on the hidden risks of electromagnetic radiation by a former CBS 60 Minutes producer, and I recommend it highly. Our theme tonight is the expression, let's talk of life. I'm speaking to you from Pleasanton, California, where I'm here for 2 to 3 months. I'm launching, my company, Solaria Advisors, is launching a new investment advisory company in partnership with a wonderful California firm, and we'll tell you more about it later. But I drove from Memphis to Montana last weekend, and then from Montana to Pleasanton yesterday and today, so that's 60 hours of drive time, and I was reminded of how incredibly beautiful this country is. I drove through South Dakota and Montana, and then down from Montana through Idaho and Nevada, coming over the Tahoe area today in snowstorms. It's very, very beautiful. And I kept listening. One of the songs I kept listening to was Mr. Bojangles, and a wonderful oldie but goodie. And there's a line in it where it's talking about Mr. Bojangles, and it says he talked of life, and it reminded me of a wonderful sermon that I heard once from a preacher who said, "I came to speak life into your situation." And I have a tendency to pray for long distances when I'm driving. It's really, if you want to arrive someplace in a happy mood, just pray for 10 hours along the interstate. But I thought about a lot about the importance of speaking life into our situation. And I know on the Solaria Report sometimes I talk a lot about the dark side of life, but that's because I want you to be able to see it and see the patterns and be able to navigate. So to me, looking at the dark side is a navigation tool, and that's useful information. But in what we talk about, we want to talk life into our situation. And one of the reasons I'm so keen to get you to separate from people and things and institutions that are bring risk into your life is there's no point in talking life to people who are secretly talking death back to you. And I'm reminded again this week, as I talk to many people in our network, about their struggles with banks. Money and markets, three big stories this week, and of course they interweave together because, of course, in the financial system, ultimately everything connects to everything. Big question, what's next for the U.S. dollar? We saw the U.S. dollar dip briefly below the 74 support line. But what we're watching, it's not just the U.S. dollar, it's the relationship between fiat currencies and real things globally. It's all part of the debasement as we try to manage unprecedented levels of debt. And it's having just incredible implications to the cost of living globally. I know driving, I kept laughing as I was driving, 60 hours of driving in a car of the kind I drive, that's an awful lot of gas, and I kept laughing and thinking, I could buy a chateau in the French Riviera, or I could simply pay for gas all the way to Montana. The sticker shock is great. I just bought gas in California after coming through Tahoe, and I put in my credit card and it said there's a 45-cent fee to use a debit card. That was a new one on me. I wasn't used to that. But I know across the country, so many people were talking of the gasoline price, and you'd pull into the gas pump, and everyone would be talking about it. It's a real sort of conversation maker. You're also seeing a lot of talk about food prices. We have the head of the World Bank basically saying we're one shock away from a crisis, And you see the conversation happen in different ways, some talking about the implications to people and the possibility of starvation in places, the other on political change, the other on the drop in emerging market stock prices. But anticipate that the importance of food, whether it's at a local level or a global level, or the impact of financial markets and geopolitics, is just going to keep increasing in the days and months ahead. So keep watching for that. So story number one is the dollar and fiat currency and the relationship to tangibles, and is that going to shift dramatically? If the dollar drops below that support line and stays, that's all bets. We're looking at a very profound shift if that happens. Okay, number two, and very much related to this, is what I call sneaking up on the digital currency. We saw a whole series of different stories. One is a subscriber reported that one of their relatives who has a store in California tried to get change from his banker, J.P. Morgan Chase, and to get ones and rolls of quarters was charged enormous fees to make that transaction. So number one, we're seeing it more expensive to use cash. We saw up on the blog, I posted the White House announcement on a push on cyber identity for your cell phones. This is all part of making it much easier to use phones, personal assistants, to pay for things, and that's all part of the push for digital currency. And so there's a real connection between a falling dollar and getting the operational logistics in place to really switch to digital currency and a global currency. And finally, three, again, not unrelated, is working toward tax hikes. I talked last week about the sudden appearance of enormous amounts of campaigns, both at the federal and global level, as well as the local level and sort of grassroots level, pushing towards a tax hike. It's not clear when that's going to happen or what's going to happen. I think the conversation has just begun. But critical dates to watch: the appropriation cycle this summer. The committees will vote out their appropriations. That will be very tied into what's happening in the revenue committees. They'll vote their appropriations out and then recess for the summer. The Bohemian Grove will meet in the Bay Area in July and August. A lot of decisions will be made, reported back, and then Congress will try and implement after Labor Day. So the interesting thing on taxes: do they think they can get enough of the logistics worked out and enough political consensus to act this fall? We'll see. It's very, very fluid. I'm realizing in my conversations with subscribers this week that something I said last week and I've said before really is not being understood at the level I think it would be helpful to have it understood. So I'm going to repeat it today, and forgive me if I'm being redundant. But it's very important that we are coming into a profound and fundamental shift between the individual citizen in the first world and the large institutions that manage resources, whether it's government or corporations. There are three changes underway in three roles that each citizen plays, and they're having a dramatic impact on the shift in power relationships. And it's very important for you to understand what that is so that you can see the extent to which the future is going to be different than the past. One is, traditionally in most first world countries, a citizen has been a voter, and their vote is counted in a variety of different ways, particularly on resource allocation issues. Now that's changing with computer voting, because there's much greater power by central forces to manipulate the votes electronically. So a voter is no longer a voter in the way they were 10 or 20 years ago. That's number one. Number two, we're seeing a rebalancing of consumption from the first world into the emerging markets. As that happens, the American consumer is no longer sort of the princess to be catered to, because that's all part of controlling access to a 300 million person unified market. That's changing now. We're seeing larger unified markets elsewhere. And so the fundamental power of the consumer is changing, particularly when that consumption is coming from government subsidies that require more debt. And so putting that consumer in a place where they can spend real money is getting more and more expensive. And three, and probably the most important thing to understand, is that the citizen in the first world has been a saver. So whether they're putting money in the pension fund, whether they're putting money into their own brokerage account or bank, whether they're putting money into a governmental retirement system like Social Security, they're generating funds that feed the system. So the money goes into the Social Security Trust Fund, but is borrowed and used to finance the deficit. And so the first world citizen for many decades now has been net energy plus in terms of producing cash for the system, whether it's cash to finance government or cash to finance the growth of multinational corporations. That saver has now turned net negative. So Social Security, where it's now projected, we're drawing out more than we're putting in. Pension funds, it's the same negative that's going to start occurring if it hasn't, depending on the fund. It's the phenomena of the baby boomers aging. And so whereas before we were creators of capital for the corporate system and the government system, now we're net users and we're trying to draw back out. And that is going to have a radical change on the fundamental relationship between the individual and the organization responsible for governance and management. And it's important to understand this because it is at the very heart. A lot of the oppressive kind of technology and rule changing that we're seeing is at the heart of those organizations trying to struggle to keep the party going. Our hero of the week, actually, I have two heroes of the week. The first is the Solari team in Montana. We had, I drove into Montana. It was like one of those speed car drivers who drives into the pit with everything broken and boom, 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 everything gets fixed in 2 days, turn around and you march out. I just want to remind everyone we have Ani E. Starr running our operations and Darlene Heckman runs our customer service and support. And it's very important to us that all aspects of our service for you as subscribers work. So if something's not working, if you're having trouble understanding, please call, please email, let us know what we can do to get things working as we want them to be. We want them to be excellent for you. The second hero is the deputy mayor of an Arab village. If you've watched Full Signal, the documentary we're going to review today, the wonderful deputy mayor of an Arab village in Israel who literally got cell towers banned within the village, and it's a remarkable story, and we'll talk about it after Blake joins us. We'll discuss the movie with her and our discussion of the smart grid. Okay, ask Catherine. We had, again, some excellent questions. Most of the financial breakdown and collapse crowd do not have your depth in global finance. Any change in percentages this week? The noise sure is loud from the crowd. Boy, is it ever. I don't know if you listened to the first quarter wrap-up, but I did change my odds. In the year-end wrap-up that I did in January, I said my scenarios for investment advisory and planning this year were 70% chance of the slow burn, 20 to 25% chance of what I call 2008 redux, which is a real seize up in the financial system, and then a 5% chance of collapse. But I continue to warn everyone that the slow burn is financed is by sequential collapse. And if you prepare for collapse, what you need to prepare for is not, you know, the whole world collapses a la the peak oil kind of fears, but you know, you have a tsunami in your area and you get a collapse. You have we've seen collapse in the Gulf. We've seen collapse in the Fukushima. We've seen collapse in Haiti. It's much more a sequential collapse that is part and parcel or is accompanied by the kind of disaster capitalism that is, helps feed the slow burn. What I did in the first quarter wrap-up is I changed those odds to 65, 25, 30, and 5. So I was struck by the danger, and it was interesting. I said this on Thursday, the Thursday night of the quarterly report, that if Fukushima continued to worsen and we got a budget shutdown and Libya continued as it was going, that the amount of fluidity in governance relationships globally was dangerous and a real opportunity for a variety of dangerous parties to make crazy. And what was interesting is literally by Monday morning, everything was back in its watertight compartments. We had Fukushima, the Japanese saying everything is much better and under control. We had the budget deal done by the president, and we had Gaddafi saying he'd welcome UN peacekeepers in Libya. So, so somebody must have agreed. But I do think it's fluid, and if we get another couple of events that have dramatic economic implications like Fukushima, and there's a real breakdown in the ability of leadership to coordinate globally, I think we could see another 2008 and particularly a major correction in the stock market. So I've changed my odds to 65, 25, 30, and 5. I don't agree with the collapse crowd generally. I think a lot of people are either talking up their book, which is, their financial position, or they're simply cranky that the breakaway civilization has left them behind. And there's no doubt that the fundamentals are absolutely dreadful. But I think they underestimate the ability of the leadership to keep the slow burn going. Now, I say that, and watching the dollar, if the dollar breaks through the 74 level and starts going down, and we really see a spiral down, then my question is that what they, it's very possible that they want that. So it's a very fluid situation, and the fundamentals are terrible. But I don't underestimate the ability of the leadership to keep the slow burn going. Now, to do that, they're going to have to continue to bleed and collapse different parts. So the risks of the situation continue to rise for people managing the kind of situations that all of us on this call are. Another question, other than filing for offshore assets, is a metal exchange and gold money deemed a taxable event? If you take a look at the article that we did on the tax issues of swapping allocated, unallocated for allocated, you'll see a discussion of the fact that a swap from gold to silver traditionally is a taxable event. Again, I defer to your CPA. It doesn't matter what I say. Ultimately, it's your CPA who's got to be the expert on this. But I always assume that a metal exchange at gold money or on a digital, any kind of situation like that, a swap from gold to silver is a taxable event. But again, I defer to, the guy who's got the clout with the IRS to say yay or nay. Oil card. What do you think about the Saudis saying the oil market is oversupplied and they are decreasing production? They're blaming inflation and a weak dollar, but the dollar has not gone down enough to explain the price spike. Is this further evidence of market manipulation, and why isn't this being talked about? Great question. I have been so stunned at the oil card manipulations to keep the price of oil up. I finally called, I emailed Jim Norman, author of the oil card, who's already been on the Solaria Report twice. I said, Jim, nobody's ever been on the Solaria Report three times, but I need you back because the oil card is one of the best descriptions I've ever seen of what's going on. And we need to get caught up on what's happening to manipulate the oil price up and what that means to geopolitics. It's also going to be a question when we talk with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson in the first week of May. We're going to have Wilkerson on in the first week, then Franklin for precious metals, and then Jim Norman. So a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is the economic warfare behind the national security issues and what that means with oil. Okay, so that's it for Ask Catherine. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce to you someone who you just heard from last month, but, it's just an amazing, amazing, all I can say is one of our heroes. Blake Leavitt is a science writer. She has what I consider to be the premier book on electromagnetic fields. That's what we talked about last month. I really encourage you to get her books. They're really a wonderful introduction and overview of a phenomena which is relatively recent and is very invisible but is having a profound impact on our lives and health. So, Blake, did you manage to get with us?
I am. I'm here.
Oh, good. Well, I can't thank you for coming back enough because the interest in learning more, we ended up in our last discussion with a question from Smart Grids on Smart Grids, and there was just incredible interest and energy, and so I am very appreciative of your taking the time to come back and join us. So why don't we just dive right in, and could you explain to us what is a smart grid?
Okay, but first I want to say it's a pleasure to be back with you, Catherine. I enjoy your program. So,
Good.
So here I am, a smart grid. Smart grids are, they are probably the dumbest thing that I've seen in a very, very long time. It is a massive restructuring of our electric utility grid, for one, but it's an extremely complex set of proposals, and it comes in three basic parts. One part is a communications branch called broadband over power lines, which will marrying a high-frequency communications factor to our power line infrastructure, creating a complicated multi-frequency field. And we can talk a little bit about why that's a problem later on. Then another component of smart grids is bringing entire new power line corridors to areas where developers hope to garner alternative energy sources like wind in windy areas like off the coast of Maine, or to solar farms in the desert. Usually in these areas we don't have power line corridors that go directly to them. So there's that component. And then there is this other component that is making people scratch their heads and say, what in heaven's name were we thinking of when we came up with this one? And that has to do with what people are literally calling the smart grid, which has to do with a complex interaction having to do with a metering system, with interior appliances, creating what are called mesh networks. And they are two-way control communication systems between an electric utility and you with your appliances. Now, let me explain exactly how that system works, and then I'll explain why there are problems with it. Eventually, what will happen is that all of your interior appliances, whether that's your microwave oven, your regular oven, your washer, your dryer, your computer, your television, your coffee maker, your furnace, your air conditioners, whatever uses electricity, will have an embedded antenna in it. And a lot of the new appliances that are being manufactured now are already coming that way. Those antennas will communicate wirelessly to another meter that's called a smart meter that is now being attached to millions of homes throughout the country. And that meter will transmit at a slightly higher frequency wirelessly to a central hub that will gather that information and maintain it for billing purposes. Now, what happens with the smart meters is that you can get aggregate exposures from one meter being bounced from your neighbor's meter to your meter to the next meter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so that you could be, at the end of that line, you could be having an aggregate exposure of, say, 500, possibly even up to 1,000 other meters before the information actually gets sent on to the central hub. It's a kind of a Frankenstein design, and this thing is so over-designed that it's just amazing. I mean, anybody that looks at it for the first time that understands what it is that they're looking at, just like I said, scratches their head and goes, what in heaven's name is going on with this? But this was all part of the federal stimulus dollars under Obama. The smart grid proposals and designs did actually start under the Bush administration. So it goes back prior to this. It's coming. It originally came out of the minds of Sam Palisano, who is the chairman of the board of IBM. Came out of GE. Came out of some of these large corporations who were looking to save money and thinking that they could do things like get rid of meter readers, which they can. Hundreds of thousands of meter readers will be laid off. You know, that's the friendly person that comes up and takes a look at your meter and figures out how much electricity that you've used. So many meter readers will be laid off. But the rationale for smart meters was ostensibly to save energy and to create something called real-time knowledge of your energy use on a day-to-day basis, sometimes on a minute-to-minute basis on in your home. And it's presumed...
Well, it gives you... It's not just real-time data on your energy use. It's real-time data on an enormous amount of consumer behavior and goods.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But as far as the individual user is concerned, it's presumed that if you know what it's costing you to do your laundry in the middle of the day, you'll put that off until midnight. So, I mean, that's the idea, is to shift energy use from high peak daytime hours to, you know, spread it out more evenly and all of that. But what they're heading toward is tiered pricing, which many states don't have. And in a lot of states now, electricity use is consumer controlled, and it's the rates are set by the states. This is all part of deregulating the energy supply. And so they're going for tiered pricing, which is in the end now understood to probably be set up to penalize the elderly or the unemployed or the self-employed or anybody that stays home during the day or stay-at-home families with young children. So if this deregulation is allowed to go national with tiered pricing, the people that can least afford to be hit with higher bills will certainly be hit with higher bills. So that's kind of it in a nutshell and what the rationale was for. Now, the problem is that it is so easy to knock all of that down that it's just kind of frightening. For one thing, the smart grids really don't save energy. As a matter of fact, in Connecticut, where I live, our Attorney General, George Jepson, has just asked our Technology and Energy and Technology Committee in the legislature to not approve a smart grid build-out in Connecticut. There was a pilot program in Connecticut of something like 10,000 households, 10,000 meters, and small businesses and private users back in 2010 to see if they actually saved energy, and in fact they don't save energy.
Why not?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that most people really don't have a choice of when to use their energy. If you're doing your laundry at night, it's usually because you work during the day and you're not home.
Right.
And everybody, you know, tends to cook dinner around the same time. We all tend to shower in the morning to get out to work. So the main amount of energy use that's being used during the day is probably through business use, and there's only so much that they can cut down on as well. But there's this other problem that goes along with this, and it's called vampire energy. There's a fundamental flaw in turning all of our metering and monitoring into a wireless device, and that's that in order to function properly, both the meters and all of the interior appliances with their antennas on, it means that there's this constant low-level sapping of energy that's created by the system itself. It's sort of like when environmentalists have been telling people to turn their television sets off if they're remote control devices, not just to turn them off but to unplug them, because even in the off mode, they're constantly on, otherwise they wouldn't be able to receive the signal to turn back on when they're called upon to do so. So equipping all of our appliances with antennas and putting smart meters on the outsides of our houses that are always in a transmit mode is actually using more energy than it's saving. So there are all of those kinds of things. There are also real billing problems with these. People have seen their bills double and quadruple in some instances, and as a matter of fact, in one smart grid build-out in Canada, I think it's in British Columbia, the utility companies are telling people to expect that their bills are going to at least double because it takes so much to actually build these systems out. So the upgrade is thought to be way beyond anything that anybody can actually recover. One of the reasons that Attorney General Jepson in Connecticut asked that the smart grid not be built out is because it was estimated it was going to be something like $500 million would be added to ratepayers' bills in order to accommodate the build out, so there are problems like that. the other
what
thing
states
that's,
have gone forward with
I'm sorry, Kathy.
What states? How many states have mandated that this proceed?
California was the first, and the first out of the gate, and they have an estimated 7 million smart meters have already been installed, but they're having real problems there. All of California is in uproar over this, and
right.
They've gone to congressional hearings. Some of the legislature asked the Council of Science and Technology to issue a special report on the exposures. One of the focuses in California, aside from vampire energy, from security, from privacy issues, and we'll talk about liability and things along those lines, but one of the main concerns has to do with the increase in radio frequency radiation from the smart meters and from all of the internal antennas that will be attached to appliances. The problem with the smart meters is that they're sending information many times a second. So in places where you've never had that kind of an exposure, or exposures are discretionary, say like with someone's wireless router, et cetera, all of a sudden you've got a utility imposing an exposure on people who don't want it. But the critical question, and this was something that was raised by Cindy Sage, who is a consultant in California, and she's also the co-editor of something called the Bio Initiative Report. Cindy's a longtime expert when it comes to electromagnetic field issues and radio frequency radiation exposures. But the one thing that she was right on top of is something called peak exposures during what's called the duty cycle. The duty cycle is when the meter or your internal appliances fire out the information. And when they fire it out initially for a fraction of a second, that fraction of a second transmission power output can actually exceed FCC standards. Now, the problem with, let me explain a little bit for anyone who didn't hear our show the last time. The problem with the FCC standards, which is the Federal Communications Commission, has a safety standards for exposures to human beings from radio frequency radiation, which is known to heat tissue the way a microwave oven cooks food. But their standards are only for what are called thermal effects, which is that heating effect. The problem with this area of the science is the fact that something called non-thermal effects, which are much more subtle but possibly devastating effects, have been noticed in the literature and in the population for many, many decades now, and there are no standards that take non-thermal effects into consideration. Now, with peak exposures possibly exceeding the FCC standards, that means that you are getting bursts of very intense radio frequency radiation, admittedly only for a fraction of a second, but this entire system is considered within the FCC guidelines, because the way the FCC sets up its guidelines is to time average exposures over a 30-minute period. So a peak exposure that's averaged over a 30-minute period with much lower exposures would tend to make that peak exposure completely disappear. But that does not mean that it's not a critical biological metric in terms of what can cause damage. One of the analogies that people have been using is that it's like firing a bullet into an internal organ and then saying, well, just because it sat there for 30 minutes doesn't mean that it's done any damage. Which is a nice graphic image of what a peak exposure actually is. So there is this raging debate going on in California about peak exposure. Cindy Sage put out a very good report that was then challenged by the Electric Power Research Institute that just said a bunch of things that everybody already knew. The California Council on Science and Technology put out a report after asking very diverse experts for their comments, and then appeared not to take those comments into consideration. They put out a report that everyone needed to challenge and try to bring up to date. Essentially, what they said was that the meters met FCC standards. Well, It's not hard to meet the FCC standards. That's not the argument. The argument is that the standards themselves are unsafe, and these peak power exposures are unsafe, and they're also involuntary exposures. So now in California, with this mass revolt that is going on out there, I mean, we're talking people going to jail. We're talking grandmothers stopping utility trucks in neighborhoods and not allowing them to drive down streets. We're talking executives for Pacific Gas and Electric who have tapped into the email networks of some of the activists, pretending that he's someone else. He's been fired. You're talking, you know, dirty tricks. You're talking all kinds of problems going on out there now. But people are adamant; they do not want this. And so there's also been a call for what's called an opt-out provision, so that those who don't want the meters don't have to have them. And in a true corporate frame of mind, PG&E is saying something along the lines of, well, people can opt out, but we're just going to have to charge much higher prices for their electricity use, because we're going to have to pay special meter readers to come out and read the old meters. So, you know, the consumer is kind of getting it, you know, both ways on this.
Right.
And people in California are up in arms. And in true industry response, they have put together a forum, I think, in Santa Rosa in the beginning of May that looks like it's going to try to address the consumer health and safety issues with smart meters. But it's really, you know, just a question of trying to decide in their parlance of how to work around citizen objection, which I think is pretty obnoxious. But that's what it is that's happening there. So,
one of the questions we got for you was, let me just read it to you. Has Blake reported or reviewed if solar has any EMF issues that are significant? It may be a way to get off the smart grid. So I think it's all part of the question of, does it make sense to become energy self-sufficient just to avoid this?
You're talking about somebody creating their own electricity, becoming their own little mini grid? Is that
uh-huh.
the nature of the question?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be a lovely thing. It's often not possible for people to do that.
Right. Right, but it seems to me that is now what I've been told, and I've never researched this independently, but what I've been told around the country is the regulation has been set up so that if you do opt out by creating your own system, then you still get charged for not using the local system. I've had subscribers and clients both opt out, both of the water system and the energy system, and had the municipality coming back around trying to charge them anyway.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I was going to say it's not just the electric companies that are trying to go with smart meters. Gas companies, water companies, anybody that has a metering system is trying to go in this direction. There are also problems with where you get multi-banks of meters, for instance, near apartment buildings or businesses or congregate housing of any kind. Those can be very, very intense radio frequency radiation environments at this point with smart meters. Oh, the other thing that I wanted to say is that smart meters are not the same thing as what I call the first generation of RF meter. Connecticut, for instance, replaced almost all of its meters, going back maybe 5 to 8 years or so, with a radio frequency radiation meter that, you know, sat on the side of the house, and a van would drive through the neighborhood and call for the information, and that meter would transmit maybe once a month. It was not something that was on all the time. The smart meter system as currently designed is like that system on steroids. It does away with the meter reader altogether, and the meter it transmits constantly. The industry says, well, they only transmit maybe, you know, once or twice a day, but they've been measured in California and elsewhere firing several times a minute, many times a minute.
Oh, my God.
Many times a minute, yeah. And that's not even if you're the one at the end of the line with all of the signals getting bounced from meter to meter to meter to meter. I mean, it's really a Frankenstein over-designed system. I mean, it's quite frightening, actually, if you start to think about it.
I was very struck by the question, one of the questions we got last time. You basically have someone in their own home and this thing is making them very ill,
yeah.
and they don't have the power to just stop it in their own home.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And that's, right, and that's very, very frightening.
Well, it is. One of the other problems is that with a smart meter that's firing continuously, it puts that signal on your domestic wiring that travels throughout your house. So it's not just a wireless component. It's actually following the lines inside your house. So you're getting a constant pulsing of radio frequency radiation that comes along with it. There are also a host of safety problems with these out in California. Again, they discovered that the meters that Pacific Gas and Electric were installing were not even UL certified. They've been known to start fires. There was another whistleblower for PG&E who came out and said that PG&E was not training its meter installers. They were being installed incorrectly, and they're complicated to install because there's a kind of a step up capacity when you go from a lower frequency to a higher frequency. So it's not like, you know, just plugging something, you know, sort of simply into your wall. It does take a lot of skill. So they're getting fires. As a matter of fact, a huge county in New Zealand outlawed smart meters altogether because they had started like something over 500 fires in a year and a half.
People
are also having circuit boards burned out after smart meters have been installed. Fans, like ceiling fans, will act erratically. They'll turn on in the middle of the night and they'll run backwards. They'll do all kinds of crazy things. So there really are safety concerns with the systems themselves. There are also safety issues with implantable devices from something called radio frequency interference. There are concerns for implantable devices for deep brain stimulators for Parkinson's patients, for instance, insulin pumps with diabetics, people with electric wheelchairs, electric beds. I mean, there are considerable problems when you get that kind of RF pulsing that has the ability to interfere with other electronics, including personal medical electronics. And then you've got the privacy issues. It's not that difficult for somebody to figure out when you're home with a smart meter system,
right.
if your energy use is being reported in real time like that. Very easy to have someone know when you're home. Also to know exactly what you're using, when you're using. There are no laws having to do with profiling you for your energy use to see, you know, how to sell you different appliances or whatever.
Right.
There are.
Yeah, it's kind of the ultimate in household spy chips.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it's like. There are also civil rights issues. There's nothing to stop the police from partnering with the utility company and, you know, snooping on you in heaven knows what ways. There are also liability issues. With this radio frequency interference component or possibility, someone with a passing cell phone passing by your house or the electric utility themselves could, you know, turn your oven on when you're not home, turn your furnace off when you're not home, freeze your pipes in the dead of winter, burn your house down, do any number of things.
Yeah, the dirty tricks possibilities are endless.
Well, and try to, you know, fight that one out with your insurance company, you know, to
right.
try and figure what's going on with that. But As if all these things aren't enough, it turns out that smart grids are actually going to make the national grid much more unstable. As a matter of fact, there was a report that was issued yesterday by one of the major national security companies that was saying that smart grids are going to make us much more vulnerable to a cyber attack. And it's been demonstrated that it's very easy to insert a worm into any particular smart meter that can affect entire regions. So there are really serious issues like that. As a matter of fact, one of the security agencies in the UK said that this is the equivalent of a nuclear catastrophe, and it's very tempting because they're really easy to hack into. So
the one of the concerns I have, I spent time working in the federal government as a government official, and then time as my company was a contractor doing financial advisory work. And what I came to believe, I had a lot of struggles. We used to call it the data beast. What I came to realize is you have all these different government agencies, and you think they're separate government agencies, but in reality, you have a handful of defense contractors who are organizing and managing all the databases.
Right.
And what was incredible was I used to have wars because the, you know, these big defense contractors would not give the data to the government officials.
Yeah.
So you couldn't get it from them, and it was clear to me that they were integrating their data from different government agencies into databases.
Right.
You know, for a variety of private parties as well as the intelligence agencies. And
right.
so
right.
you know, the reality is, you know, they were creating these monster databases. Well, then when the latest census came around, we had several Slattery reports, special write-ups on the census. And the lead contractor for the census was IBM.
Yeah.
And so when you said IBM was the lead on the smart grids, I just said, oh, my Lord, the taxpayers just paid to build the ultimate database for IBM.
Right. Well, let me tell you what this started out as. It started out as a $3 billion appropriations through the Department of Energy under Stephen Chu. This is under the Obama administration. But before the Obama administration even took office, Carol Bronner, who used to be Clinton's director of the Environmental Protection Agency and is now Obama's coordinator for climate and energy policy, she met with Sam Palisano from IBM. And IBM, this was before Obama was even in, this was when she was his transition coordinator. IBM was already working prior to all of this under the Bush administration with something called the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, which is a think tank in D.C. And IBM was developing three specific focus areas. One was increased broadband access, which we talked about, broadband over power lines. The other is digitized medical records, which is a radio frequency way of storing all of your medical data, and smart grids. And Palisano told Bronner that he needed a $10 billion investment just to jumpstart smart grids. And so, and he also told her that at the time that it would create 239,000 new jobs. Half of that would result in startup businesses, but in reality it worked out to be just the exact opposite. The smart grid technology has really created almost no jobs and is actually costing jobs at this point in time. The smart grid appropriations through the Department of Energy and various other agencies now is at $10 billion through 2011. And it's interesting because the Tea Party has focused on this. Rand Paul has come out and said, this is crazy. This is just an example of big government gone crazy. And I wouldn't normally agree with those people, but boy, I sure agree with him on that. But let me give you an idea. Who's actually involved with this? I wrote up a list. General Electric, for instance, is the largest manufacturer in the world of smart meters. IBM puts together all of the various component computer parts that make the whole thing function. Siemens is involved. Intel, Texas Instruments, Verizon, AT&T, and Motorola. Google is involved, and they are beginning to deploy some of the smart grid over the 4G network, which was supposed to be used to bring wireless internet connectivity to rural areas, but it's now being used to for smart grid deployment. The other thing that I also wanted to mention in terms of energy storage or in terms of energy usage, when they say that smart grids will save energy, they did not factor in the amount of energy required to swap out the meters or to dispose of the old ones, to build the new ones, or to store all of this data. Data storage has gotten to be a real energy hog. And if we're redesigning the entire grid to store our electricity use in real time, I mean, that just is not an intelligent thing to be doing. The other problem is that the environmentalists have embraced this with a frenzy. They really bought into the idea that this was going to save energy. As a matter of fact, smart grids are the cornerstone of many environmental policies. Some of our best known and beloved environmentalists are very supportive of smart grids. That would include Al Gore. That would include President Clinton. That now includes the Natural Resources Defense Council. It includes people like Robert Kennedy Jr. Most of the environmentalists these days, and there are large forums and conferences that are going on with a lot of young environmentalists who are very gung-ho for the development of alternative energy. But in every single case, smart grid technologies are considered the cornerstone of progressive environmentalism, and that's because nobody's taking a look at the bigger issues, and they're certainly not paying attention to how these systems actually function.
Well, when you think about it, there's under the law and the common law, one of the principal tenets in our culture is that a person's home is their castle. And within those boundaries, you know, we are the dictator of our own home. And what this is saying is that a utility or a private corporation has a right to, in essence, in the worst case, completely destroy the value of the home of your home.
That's right.
And give a variety of private parties the ability to play all sorts of games and dirty tricks inside your home whenever they want, in a way that is both invisible and you could never prove it, and it would be very difficult to stop. So it's basically saying that you give an option to a group of private parties to destroy the economic value of your home, period.
Yes. Yeah.
And to me, that is insane.
And like I said, you take a look at this, and it looks really crazy. If you really take a look at it, all the component parts, it looks very crazy.
Right. It is. Now, so let's say I'm listening to this report, Blake, and I'm thinking, the last thing I want is one of these on my home.
Uh-huh.
What do I do? How do I avoid this? How do I stop this?
Good luck. You're going to have to raise an absolute ruckus the way they have in California. Maine, by the way, the governor of Maine recently came out and said that citizens should be allowed to opt out. And now the argument is over whether they can opt out without having to pay a small fortune. People are not going to be allowed to read their own meters. Someone's going to have to come and do it for you. It's just a question of putting up a big fuss. I mean, it's dangerous. You can't go out and rip it off yourself. There's really not very much that you can do. And with the new appliances that are being sold, you can't disable the internal antenna without voiding the warranty. And it could possibly be illegal to do something like that because you could be charged with energy theft. It's a rolling nightmare. What people have to do is contact their legislators, both federally. Contact the Environment Committee, Energy and Environment committees in the House and in the Senate, and tell them that you do not want the continuation of the smart grid as it's designed. And that's a really important point, because there is a way to, for instance, for $11 billion, we could have brought fiber optic cable to every single house in the country, which would have allowed for communications, for high-speed internet, for real-time billing, electricity knowledge, if anybody still thinks that's something that they want to do, with essentially no RF component to it. It could be made safe. There would be no vampire energy associated with it. It would be safer in every possible way. It's just that these big players wanted to go wireless because it's cheaper to do that. It's much cheaper to...
also think it creates all sorts of control possibilities that the
fiber Well, let me tell you actually where I think they're headed, and there are already a couple of models that exist for this. I think that they want to get away from paper billing altogether. I think that they're going toward prepaid meters. There was a thing that happened in South Africa probably about 4 or 5 years ago, in which they discovered that they couldn't do paper billing to some of these very remote villages when they tried to electrify them, because the people didn't even even have addresses. And so what they did was they devised prepaid meters that they would sell people. They would go home, attach them to their houses, and they would be activated remotely. They also discovered that if they went to a complete prepaid meter system, that they could do automatic shutoffs. So there would be nobody would be using the electricity if they weren't paying their bill. In other words, if you don't pay your bill, your electricity goes off. So they wanted to be able to remotely control your energy usage from that perspective too. So that's where I think they're going. And if the utility companies would not go the way of deregulation, or not completely go the way of deregulation, many of them already have, not be beholden to stockholders, then they wouldn't have to be making these kinds of profits. But that's where they're going. They want to go to prepaid meters that are remotely controlled. They also there's also good possibility that they might, because there's nothing to stop them from doing this either, is that once they understand when you're really using electricity, they could set a special tiered price just for you. There's nothing to stop them from doing that. So say you work the night shift and you use more electricity at night, when electricity is lowest for everybody else, for you it might actually be higher. There's nothing to stop them from doing that either.
And they would do that in a second.
Yeah.
It's pricing optimization. I can tell you all about it. They would do it in a second. One more question. Metal homes grid. I presume a metal shelled or sheathed home would cause significant problems with a smart grid installed. The shipping container homes, campers, trailer homes, and such might cause the frequencies to bound around more?
Yeah, it could be, they could bound around more, both on the interior and the exterior, but that kind of a situation, if you get some sort of abnormal signaling characteristics, that's the kind of thing that could force bills to jump. As a matter of fact, I was reading something in which somebody had a $200 bill, and the following month after smart meter was put in, she had a $2,000 bill.
Oh my word, that's kind of one of those iPhone horror stories.
$2,000. $2,000. And
did they make her pay it, or
they're still in some kind of dispute, but one of the things that PG&E said was that about 23,000 of their meters might have been defective, but it didn't cause the billing. And one of the other things that they're saying is that actually these were accurate utility use all along. So the old meters were giving people a break. I mean, it's all over the place. But in reality, the system is not to be trusted. They're very buggy. They're just really buggy, and people can fool around with them in any capacity. It's not that difficult, for instance, to use jamming devices to black out entire neighborhoods. I mean, it's just inviting an awful lot of trouble.
It's
just too tempting.
Right.
It's just too tempting. Everybody from cyber attackers to high school kids are going to want to fool around with this one.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about, let's go to the movies, our documentary Full Signal. Uh-huh. This was one, this is really a remarkable documentary, and one of the reasons I liked it so much is the producer is not, is Pakistani, and...
No, he's Palestinian.
Oh, he's Palestinian. I thought he was, that's right, he's Palestinian-American.
He's Palestinian-American who lives in Israel, yeah.
It's much more global in you're seeing the full challenge of this in Europe and in the Middle East and in America. So, you know, there's much more context to it.
Uh-huh.
And I really liked that. But the one thing, why don't you introduce it? Because you're certainly one of the people in it. And maybe if you could just give us 2 minutes on what this is and why we should watch it.
Well, it's a visual and a documentary exploration of just exactly how much wireless exposure we're getting these days. And Talal interviewed many people, myself being one of them, but he also interviewed David Carpenter, who's the other co-editor of the Bioinitiative Report and a world-class epidemiologist in New York. He interviewed Luce Lesson, who's the publisher and editor of Microwave News. Luce has been covering the subject for well over 30 years, I think. Interviewed several activists in America, throughout Europe. He interviewed some people who are electrically hypersensitive. which is a disability that's considered a functional disability in Sweden, but not elsewhere. And it's essentially a form of electric allergy in which people become disabled by wireless devices in particular and have to be very careful what it is that they do. So we interviewed people like that. He also showed footage of villages in Israel that were a combination of Palestinians and Arabs and Coptic Christians who were united against cell antennas being installed on rooftops. So it's a fascinating global picture of what's going on out there.
He interviewed
a lot of scientists.
Yeah, it's very good interviews. He found amazing people.
Yeah,
very thoughtful, very knowledgeable. But the story I wanted to highlight tonight was this this village in northern Israel, where you had a pattern of people getting cancer, and after investigation, what they realized was the cancers were happening right next to where there were antennas.
Yeah.
And
a very good study that was done by Wolf and Wolf, if anybody wants to try and find the study, that traced incidence of cancer episodes near where the antenna installations were also. So there was actually an epidemiology study that tracked that too in Israel.
The thing that I thought was so remarkable about their organizing an effort to outlaw the antennas was coming up with this sort of declaration that this technology was a violation of the sacred.
Yeah.
And then spreading that and getting sort of consensus on that before then saying, okay, now what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And once you build a consensus that something is a violation of the sacred, it's a more logical next step.
Yeah.
And it really struck me because I'm leaving a wonderful community because of their adoption of cell tower technology, and I could never get them to see the connection between, you know, this desire to hold life as sacred and what this technology might do.
Where is that?
So I thought, hey, that's in Tennessee. That's my home in Tennessee. I'm leaving because I now have what looks like a hideous version. It's like a nightmare version of the Eiffel Tower right behind my house with a flashing red light atop. But it's, you know, it's just not safe.
Yeah.
So, but it's this challenge that we're all having with this stuff, which is you wake up one day in the home. It's like the couple, there's a wonderful couple in Full Signal who, I think their name, it's Sue and Michael Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget where they are. I think it's California.
No, they're in New York.
Somewhere in the...
As a matter of fact,
they're in New York.
They just lost their, their lawsuit, as a matter of fact.
So they buy a big expensive home, and the next thing they discover is, you know, their health has been destroyed, and their home is not their castle.
Right.
So it's a very tricky thing. Now, okay, take 1 minute and explain how we can access your website, your books, your work.
I don't really do very much in the way of self-promotion. I maintain a website through the Authors Guild, and I need to update it, and I just never seem to, on any particular day, go there to do that. But my works are listed there, and it would be through www.blake.com.
Well, you have been kind enough to send me your latest articles on the smart grid, and I've posted all of them at the blog. So, anytime you want to, every time you publish, if you will send me a link, I will make sure it gets up on the blog as well.
I will indeed. If people want to contact others who have very good websites available or who are certainly as knowledgeable as I am about this, there's a woman named Sandy Maurer, S-A-N-D-I, Maurer, M-A-U-R-E-R, and she runs something called the EMF Safety Network in California. You can just access her website. There's a pile of information there. Cindy Sage, Google Cindy Sage Consultants, she's got got a wealth of information. Another woman named Mary Beth Brangan, B-R-A-N-G-A-N, at Eon, which is a health website. She's got some very good information. And a radio interviewer named Lena Berman, who is one of the co-hosts of something called Your Own Health and Fitness, which is on Pacifica Radio, has interviewed me several times, and Cindy Sage, and has had others on, and has some very good shows that are archived on the subject. So there's a lot of good information out there.
There really is. There really is. Well, Blake, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on the Salieri Report. You have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too. Thank you for all your work, Catherine.
Okay, coming up May 5th, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson on national security. When I was a government official, I had what I used to call my sugar pack goals, and it was, okay, what's my real agenda? What am I really trying to get accomplished? And what I asked Larry to do was to, what we're going to do is literally pretend that he's walking in the door as the national security advisor today. What's on his plate, and how does that integrate with what we're seeing in the financial markets and in the investment world? What's the world look like from the point of view of the National Security Advisor at the United States and from the point of view of the person sitting in the Oval Office? Then Franklin again on May 12th. Given the real breakout in precious metals, we have a lot of talk to there. On May 19th, as I said, Jim and Norman back with the Oil Card. If you haven't read his book, The Oil Card, I recommend it very strongly. It's one of the best books to help understand what in the world is going on in the 21st century. I want to remind you, with your control panel, we're starting to make more and more transcripts. We've done a lot. If you go to your control panel and look at the archive for 2011, we put up one for the year-end wrap-up in January. We for radiation poisoning with Laura Thompson, Gwen Scott, on how to protect yourself from chemtrails, the top 25 food documentaries. We're doing progressively the top 10 dates in precious metals, so we did the 6 out of 10, and those are all up at your control panel. And I would really encourage you to feel free to share these with family and friends, particularly where it helps you to engage. You know, it's always easier to take these actions when you're doing it in cahoots with the people that you love. I'm headed tomorrow to Pennsylvania to visit family for Easter, and I will be back in California on Tuesday. I hope all of you have a wonderful Easter vacation, holiday, weekend. And while you're at it, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.